We're ready for our second oral argument presentation. I'll ask our marshal to call the case for consideration.
Now, here is case number 8221688 in the matter of SIRS, appeal by Best Care LLC.
Give you a few minutes to settle in. Just a reminder, you each have 15 minutes for presentation of your argument. 5 minutes is reserved to appellant, relator counsel if you choose to use that. And are you not splitting time, or are you?
No, Your Honor.
All right. And remember to introduce yourself and your client before you begin your remarks.
May it please the court. My name is Sam Orbovich. With me is Pari Magera. We're from the law firm Frederickson & Byron. We represent relator Best Care LLC. The CEO of Best Care, Andre Best, is with us in the courtroom today, as is the chief strategy officer, Leanne Lindahl. This is a judicial review of a final agency order in a contested case proceeding under the Administrative Procedure Act. The question presented is whether this court should affirm, reverse, or modify the commissioner designee's final order. That final order affirmed a stipulated provider agreement and a $428,393.13 monetary recovery against relator Best Care. The relief requested is that you reverse the final order and the sanction and monetary recovery in their entirety. The scope of review is under Minnesota Statutes 14.69. You may reverse the agency order if it exceeds statutory authority, violates constitutional provisions, is made upon unlawful procedure, is affected by other error of law, unsupported by substantial evidence in view of the entire record, or arbitrary and capricious.
So, Mr. Orbovich, I authored one Best Care, so I'm familiar. And I'm glad that the party said this is not the same Best Care as one Best Care. Those other cases focused on Rule 9, I'll just call it 9505. They did not focus on the statute and the statutory language. And we couldn't find any cases that addressed the statutory language improper payment. And so I'm wondering if you think this should be a precedential case, and I'll ask opposing counsel the same question, and if so, what the syllabus point would be.
I do believe, Your Honor, that it's time for the Court of Appeals to issue a precedential case on this subject matter. By my count, there have been 4 opinions rendered by this court, 2 of which are pending before the Minnesota Supreme Court, Nobility and Trinity, and were argued about 2 weeks ago. The decision that you authored in One Best Care and also Smart Choice. And in each of those decisions, the Court of Appeals affirmed DHS's recovery and sanctions, pretty much, like you say, relying on 9505, which is a rule the DHS promulgated in about 2007 or 2008, I believe. There are 2 reasons why this court should issue a precedential decision that deviates and is different from those 4 non-precedential decisions. First, the factual record here distinguishes Best Care from those decisions. And second, the court—
Because it's only four, it was 49, right? Is it 49 documents? Is that the number?
49 documents, Your Honor.
That you misplaced, that were in the cloud?
69.
69.
69 timesheets.
Time
69 timesheets that were not available, or Best Care believed that they had been produced.
But was there reasoning given, help my memory here, was there reasoning given on why they were not accepted, just too late, or
due diligence, or what was the rationale?
The testimony from Andre Best was that when Best Care relayed all the documents that CSRS and DHS asked for, he thought, and Best Care thought, that everything had been submitted. When they received the $446,000 recovery or demand, he realized that there had been missing timesheets in the production. And what happened was, it was a technical snafu with the way that they preserved the documents.
Stuff happens.
Yeah.
And I follow that too, but I mean, wouldn't it have been your burden of production? I mean, you know, you don't get to get another bite at the apple and say, oh, we forgot to give that. That's what I'm getting at.
Yeah, well, it seems to me we do get to take another bite of the apple at the contested case itself. During the audit, and there was no visit by DHS or CSRS. They just sent a letter, please send us information. During that period of time, those didn't arrive. Even though the letter from DHS said, you can provide more information, the $446,000 letter. Later, at the contested case, even before the contested case, with the appeal, we filed the 69 timesheets. DHS never proved that they were that they weren't authentic or that they had any problems with them. They just ignored them. And under this court's ruling in 1998, in the case In re Appeal of Sleepy Eye, you'd think I'd remember it. It was my case. This court said that Administrative Procedure Acts and contested case proceedings are de novo reviews. Following the Jester Brother case, that was a 1943 Supreme Court case that criticized an agency because they wouldn't let the regulatory party put evidence on.
Right, but I mean, at the end of the day, as I understand it, there's no indication that these 69 timesheets would have demonstrated that, you know, you were double billing or, you know, blah, blah, blah. Okay. So the issue is you didn't provide them. And, you know, under rule, you know, the three subparts of the rule that the commissioner relied on to, you know, yank the money. One is failing to disclose or make available to the department the recipient's health service records or the vendor's financial records. And when they asked for them, 49 documents were missing. That's one of the deemed practices, one of the 22 that seems to be a red flag. The cases, you know, Smart Choice and Best Buy, seem to say, it says what it says, you know. Why is the department wrong? Because at the end of the day, you know, either failing to disclose them or make available when they asked for them, or failing to develop and maintain records, you know, why is, well, you know, they were in the cloud, no harm, no foul. Why do you get to say that when the cases seem to suggest you don't?
Well, the cases, there are no cases that say we don't. The Rule 9505 that you referred to, the deemed abuse rule, and the statute that says that you must produce, the administrative law judge, first of all, his finding.
Doesn't that assume that it's deemed to produce when we ask for them? And I seem to recall that case law says it's not substantial compliance, it's we want them when we want them, give us to them when we want them. You didn't. And yes, in the scheme of things, do I think this is a huge deal when I think the record indicates there's 2,400 timesheets twice a week or twice a month, I think?
Yes.
No. I mean, this seems, this doesn't seem to be quite fair. But, you know, the flip side is the department's very concerned about, you know, as I'm sure everyone in this building, including your clients, healthcare fraud and abuse. And it's kind of like it's your obligation to get it right the first time and not lose stuff in the cloud. And if you do, them's the breaks.
Yeah, well, why am I
wrong?
Well, first of all, the law doesn't say that. And the reason that I know that is as we sit here right now, DHS is pushing four bills in the legislature which change 256B.064 to include the language, any records not provided to the commissioner at the date and time of the request are inadmissible if offered as evidence by the provider in any proceeding to contest sanctions against monetary recovery from the provider. That's Senate File 2819 and three other bills. If they needed to change the law, then the law certainly isn't what DHS is advancing in the final order. But secondly, it's not just whether abuse is proven, whether abuse is deemed. That's only the start of the analysis. The element in the statute is that you have to prove an improper payment resulted from that. And in a contested case proceeding, yes.
What statute, rule, or case says precisely what you're telling me?
256B.064, subdivision 1C, indicates, and let's go to the regulatory definition of abuse, which is that CSRS has to prove a pattern of practices that are inconsistent with sound fiscal, business, or healthcare service practices, and that result in unnecessary costs to the program or in reimbursements for services that are not medically necessary. It's not just that there is a deemed abuse. They need to prove improper payment. And the other point that's important.
That gets me back to my original question. Let's say that I agree with you that it should be precedential. So what's your syllabus point?
That inconsequential and immaterial omissions in documentation does not constitute abuse and does not qualify as for either monetary recovery or stipulated provider agreements.
Yeah, I don't know if I like that one.
Yeah.
I think you have to get back to, I'm not telling you how to argue your case, but I think you have to get back to 256B.064 subdivision 1CA. Which says the commissioner may obtain monetary recovery, and I think that's what we have here. There are fines and sanctions and monetary recovery that are permitted under the statutory scheme from a vendor who has been improperly paid as a result of conduct described in 1A.
Improperly paid are the key words. The significant fact here is that regardless of the 69 documents that weren't produced, regardless of the irregularities that CSRS found, every single claim submitted by my client under these documents was correct. It had
except for the
$5,046, yeah. I was about to say, except for $5,046. But there's one other statute that keeps being omitted here in the four cases, and that's 256B.0659. Which is the controlling statute for the two PCA programs, PCA Choice and PCA Traditional.
And I was going to ask you about that, too, because you have differing interpretations of where those records should reside.
That's certainly one point, but there's another one. Under 256B.0659, subdivision 28B, the legislature specifies that if a PCA agency does not, quote, consistently comply with the PCA statute's documentation requirements, the commissioner is authorized to impose a fine of up to $500. $500. This tells us that not every flawed PCA document automatically constitutes abuse. If the legislature provides...
But I mean, this, and I don't know if it's the statute or the rule, but it gives... As I understand it, and I agree, that makes sense, but there is a choice that the commissioner can make. They can either impose the fine or, my words, not yours, get all the money back. And isn't that choice, and they chose this one, and how is that substantially, you're right, you know what, it seems to me this is not a $500,000 deal.
Right.
But, you know... I don't know. Maybe they're trying to send a message. What do I know? And if they have the choice of a fine or getting the money back, they chose to do it this way. Why is that an error? Why is that arbitrary and capricious, counsel?
They only have the choice if they prove abuse or theft or fraud.
And that goes back to your argument that abuse has to be a pattern, resulting in of overpayment or whatever the matter is.
Yes, and a pattern of practices. If... You know, the word abuse is not defined in 256B.064. So if we start with the plain meaning of abuse, the dictionary definition by the American Heritage College Dictionary is a corrupt practice or custom. That is not inconsistent with the regulatory rule here. And a missing UMPI number, unique Minnesota provider identification number on a timesheet, or whether or not a timesheet mistakenly circled shared services instead of individual services, or for that matter, not producing records right away, but later at the contested case appeal, none of those fit the definition of what I would consider abuse. And if that's the point, then the commissioner does not have the discretion to do anything other than the statutory $500 fine.
Even if those 22 items are deemed abuse?
Deemed abuse is two prongs to the test. Deemed abuse or proven abuse and proof of improper payment. And that's where this case fails. There is no proof of improper payment other than the $5,046. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Benjamin Johnson. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I'm here on behalf of the respondent, the Minnesota Department of Human Services. And we're here to ask the court to affirm the agency's action here in which it upheld the overpayment and the stipulated provider agreement. We ask for affirmance for two reasons, essentially. First, that the agency correctly applied the law. The court applied what we believe are unambiguous statutes and regulations according to their plain language and in a manner that this court has held in a number of recent unpublished decisions is the correct interpretation. And then secondly, that the agency's factual findings are supported by substantial evidence. The agency here, Your Honors, I believe did precisely what the Supreme Court in the Blue Cross Blue Shield excess surplus case instructed an agency should do in an administrative proceeding like this.
So what would your syllabus point be?
If the court were to publish a precedential decision here, the syllabus point, I believe, Your Honor, would be consistent with the opinion you authored in One Best Care, and that is that the statute at issue here is clear and unambiguous.
Consider the statute in One Best Care.
Well, I believe you did, Your Honor, when you said that the statute and the rule must be read together. Mr. Orbovich's arguments are slightly different, I think, than the arguments raised in that case, but I am familiar, and I even listened to the oral argument in that case last night.
So let me ask you this, because when I read Rule 9505 and I look at 256B.064 Subdivision 1, what does improperly paid mean to the agency?
That's a good question, Your Honor, and I...
Because it seems to be that it's an overpayment. You're not saying that services weren't rendered or that there was a duplication other than the $5,000. The money that was paid for services that Best Care rendered to people needing PCA care, as I read the record.
Essentially, Your Honor, I guess we wouldn't concede that there was no issue with whether the services were provided, but our position is we don't have to prove that the services were not provided. And with respect to your question about
Does improperly paid mean?
Yes, Your Honor, and I think the way to answer that is to read the statute as a whole and read the entire, it's Subdivision 1C, Grounds for and Methods of Monetary Recovery. And that's distinct from sanctions. That's in a separate subdivision.
And you would say that fines are distinct from sanctions and monetary recovery?
A fine is a type of sanction. And I think in order to issue a fine, that would come under Subdivision 1B.
Okay, so tell me how I should read Subdivision 1C.
Sure. So improperly paid, what does improperly paid? It's not defined elsewhere in the statute. And I would submit, Your Honors, that the plain language of that means exactly what it says. Improper is an adjective. It means the opposite of proper.
But Black Law Dictionary has a nice readily available definition of improper, which is contrary to your position, because in that context, it's unsuitable or irregular, fraudulent, or wrongful. And you're not saying there was any fraud here. That's not your point. You're not making that accusation.
No, but I would say unsuitable would fit, Your Honor. And I think what demonstrates this perhaps best...
Unsuitable because when we asked for the records to justify the payment, some records were missing. Is that sort of the bottom line?
That's one part of it.
The records that would have... The records that support all the payments were, you know, let's pick a word, incomplete, not produced when we asked for them, blah, blah, blah. And therefore, that's what is the problem.
There were numerous deficiencies in the records. Counsel focuses on these 69 timesheets that weren't produced. There's many more, but however we describe it, errors, deficiencies, insufficiencies in the records, it meets the definition of abuse in the rule. So with respect to improperly paid, it means unsuitable in the sense that it should not have been paid. This is an overpayment, and so this legislature granted DHS broad authority to claw back these payments. And I think what best illustrates this, Your Honors, is so we're talking about this is an abuse case, but Subdivision 1C also talks about error, and that error can be on the part of the agency or it can be on the part of DHS. So we could have a circumstance where a provider agency like Best Care here did everything right, their records were perfect, they documented everything, but DHS determines that it made an error in paying these public funds, and under the statute, that would be improperly paid, meaning shouldn't have been paid in the first place, and DHS is entitled to claw back that money.
We get so muddied up on all of this. So if that's the case, then it seems to me DHS would never want to go after the fine. I mean, why would you? You could go for it all. Do you see what I'm getting at? I mean, that wouldn't make sense because then why would you even have that option? You wouldn't go for that option. You'd go for the big pool, whichever is largest.
Well, perhaps, Your Honor, if DHS is... motivation is to obtain as much money as possible, but I think we do need to defer to the agency with respect to what it feels is best when administering this program and protecting these public funds. And so I don't believe it's in the record here as to what exactly their motivation is across the board or in this case, but the legislature granted DHS with a lot of tools and broad authority to address potential fraud, waste, and abuse in this program.
You know, Mr. Johnson, you know, no analogies are perfect, but you know, in a civil trial, if you disclose the documents late, the court can take a variety of options. It can fine you. It can say, we're going to enter an adverse jury instruction saying, you know, assume that the documents would have hurt your side if they're not produced. Or, you know, the court could take the nuclear option and then enter a default judgment. And, you know, you can disagree. It seems like, you know, your client took the nuclear option under that scenario, particularly since you agree none of these missing 69 documents or timesheets, none of them indicate that there was double billing or fraud or, you know, the clients didn't get the work they got, right?
Well, we don't know that, Your Honor. I say that concession wasn't made below, but I can see that DHS did.
There was a concession for some, like, 50,000 or something. Wasn't there a concession that there had been double billing on some piece?
Yes, there was a concession by the agency, by the provider agency here, that there was double billing in multiple
forms. As to the 69 timesheets?
No, not with respect to the 69 timesheets. But the 69 timesheets, Your Honor, were not studied in depth by DHS. There is testimony in the record, and this comes from Melanie.
Well, did you eventually get them?
Yes, after the appeal.
I got to believe if there was something in there, you'd be leading with that item in the brief, right? Would that be a fair comment?
Well, I would, but it wasn't something that the investigators focused on, and here's why. First, there is testimony in the
record.
Because
it was just, we asked for them, we didn't get them in time, they're in the cloud, too late, too little.
Well, essentially, Your Honor,
correct me if I'm wrong, because my understanding is that there are motions in limine before the hearing in front of the ALJ.
Correct.
And the ALJ considered the 69 timesheets.
Correct.
And I don't see that the commissioner didn't consider them in the commissioner's final order.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I think if we actually look at the difference between the ALJ and the final agency decision here, the ALJ made 34 findings of fact, 20 conclusions of law. The agency then conducted its own independent review.
That's the de novo. So when it's de novo, they just disregard anything or any findings that the ALJ would have made? I mean, to me, that doesn't seem practical.
Well,
why have an ALJ if you're going to do that all the time?
Well, the Minnesota Supreme Court has instructed that an independent review has to be done, and it can't simply be. It would be improper to rubber stamp it here. The ALJ's report and recommendation is just that. It's a recommendation, and the agency has its own obligation to review it.
Well,
but
here's what this court does, though. I mean, I think you know that. If we're going to do a de novo review, I mean, we at least discuss what the trial court said or thought. I mean, we at least analyze it, and that's why I always think that's such a missing piece, because it looks as if you just shrugged it off.
Well, and that's sort of been a theme, I think, in the briefs of the appellant here, but I would encourage the court to actually look at the differences between what the ALJ found and what the commissioner finally found here. There were 34 findings of fact by the ALJ. The agency accepted 31 of those findings of fact, and it modified three. It didn't reject any. And included in those findings of fact, Your Honors, are these findings about these 69 timesheets. And I feel like we're getting sidetracked a little bit about that. I want to put into context those 69 timesheets. It's a very minuscule portion of this total overpayment. There were 9 different categories of errors found in this audit. There were, I think, 3,500 different claim lines, numerous deficiencies. And there's testimony in the record. This is from one of the CERS supervisors, Melanie Labrie. And this wasn't from questioning for me or from counsel. This was the ALJ who wanted to know, well, what about these 69 timesheets? You really didn't consider them? And she said, well, no, because our position is the documents have to be provided at the time of the audit. That's what the rule says. That's what the statute says. But she said, even a cursory review of these shows me that there were other deficiencies. And even in those claim lines that the timesheets were for, there's overlapping deficiencies. Some of these,
I mean, the ALJ in conclusions of law, I'm looking at the ones that the commissioner struck, 8, 9, and 10, which is where the ALJ takes the agency, the DHS agency, to task for failing to consider and failing to review, and therefore not providing any credible backup for its allegations. I mean, but those are the ones that the commissioner struck.
Correct, Your Honor.
And the ALJ was the one who heard the testimony, saw the witnesses, considered everything, and made those really credibility determinations, and those were disregarded, well, struck, not just disregarded, but struck by the department.
Well, I guess I would quibble with describing them as credibility determinations. I think these were conclusions of law that the agency struck or modified, and I think with
no credible evidence to support its allegations
of some of these deficiencies.
I want to ask, because I don't understand this part of some of the problems. There was a 3-to-1 and 1-to-1.
Yes.
You know what I'm talking about? Can
sure.
you explain that to me?
Yeah, the testimony in the record, Your Honor, is that some PCA recipients may be approved for and receive care that's a 1-to-1 ratio, so one PCA, a single PCA to a single recipient. Others can receive shared care, so one PCA may provide to 3 recipients. And so one category of deficiencies found here was that Best Care billed for a ratio that was different than what was reflected in the timesheets by the PCA providers.
So as a practical matter, I'll pick 30 because it's easily divided by 3. So if it's 3-to-1, then it would be $10 as opposed to $30.
I think the testimony is that actually the reimbursement rate for shared care 3-to-1 is slightly less than 1-to-1 care, or perhaps maybe have that backwards. Mr. Orbovich will correct me, I'm sure. But the point here, Your Honor, is that that requirement is in the statute. It says that timesheets must have these elements, and so with good reason, I
believe.
Okay,
let's talk about care plans.
Yeah.
Because that's also an issue here.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Tell me your understanding of the law with regard to that.
Care plans are required.
I mean, with regard to choice versus regular PCA.
Yeah. Care plans are required, Your Honor, under either program, and I think that's clear in the statute. That comes from Subdivision 7. It says that care plans are required. They must be in the agency's file. The argument by counsel here, and it was one that was made in the One Best Care case where you authored the opinion with a slightly different tweak on it, I guess, was similar to Mr. Orbovich, and it took a, I think, out-of-context portion of the long PCA program statute, which has 31 subdivisions, and it said, well, in the choice program, a care plan is initiated by the recipient with the qualified professional, assisting as needed. But we have to look at the statute as a whole, Your Honor, and if we look at the statute as a whole, it makes clear that care plans are required under either program, and they're significant. They're a very important document, and there's other provisions of the statute that I think emphasize this, including Subdivision 10, Subdivision 11, it says that PCAs have to provide covered services according to the recipient's care plan. And Subdivision 12, it says timesheets must correspond to the person's care plan. And so if we just disregard and somehow read out of the statute the requirement that care plans must exist, be in the agency's file, and the agency is responsible for ensuring that services are provided in accordance with that care plan, it would render the checks and balances that are part of this program sort of ineffective, because the agency could simply shirk its duty for having to confirm that the services that were provided and billed for were actually what the recipient wanted and were according to the care plan. I see I'm out of time, Your Honors.
One more question.
Yes.
So Rule 9505, which I read but didn't study, it defines abuse.
Yes.
Does anywhere in the rule, does it define improperly paid?
It does not, Your Honor. That's correct.
Thank you.
Okay.
And then I had one more question, Judge Werke. So looking at the rule again, the focus was on subparts 1, 7, and 9. I mean, isn't your strongest argument that it's 9? Failing to disclose or make available to the department the recipient's health service records or the vendor's financial records? I mean, isn't that the main one?
No, I can explain it.
So go ahead.
And I think the reason for that, Your Honor, and it's this is a big record, and it's a bit hard to get our hands on. I think we're still focusing on those 69 timesheets. With respect to that error deficiency, yes, that falls squarely under Division 9. But this is not a one-legged stool. This is a nine-legged stool. There's nine different categories of deficiencies that they found here that are much more significant, I think, including the lacking care plans, than those 69 timesheets.
Give me three of the nine.
Overbilling, essentially overlapping claims. There were three, and counsel, they conceded this, so the monetary amount wasn't at issue, but
that's the $5,000, though.
That's the $5,000,
yeah. But the $490, okay, go ahead.
Others with respect to not having care plans or care plans lacking required elements, not signed.
The number?
All of it adds up.
Okay.
Up
but to the number, I mean, I thought they had a good argument that, you know, we can't give you the number because it's not like, you know, you think the victim, or not the victim, the person who needs the attendant, he's going to give you the number right that day when you roll in. Good luck. I mean, my mom never did that. I can tell you that right now. And I don't know if I could find the number for you that day to fill it out.
Oh, the telephone number.
No. The IMP number. OMP. Who's got that number?
UMP number. That's the PCA identification number. So it's the PCA themselves who are in the system,
and they have that number the day they show up to give mom a bath.
Well, in most cases, yes. There was testimony in this case that sometimes it takes a while for DHS to assign that number. But again, Your Honor, this
then,
is
then then well Well, if it's your problem because you're too late assigning the number, how is it his problem when you, I mean, that does seem to be a stretch to me. I mean, that's my comment, so. So I've got nothing else.
Anything else?
Your Honors, I'll encourage the court to obviously affirm with respect to Judge Riley's question, should this be a precedential decision, and if so, what should the syllabus be? I think the court has addressed this in a number of cases, four cases recently. There was one issued on Monday also. I think the law is clear and unambiguous and unsettled here. I don't know that it's necessary, but if the court, you know, would like to, obviously. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Goodbye, students. Have a good day. And Mr. Orbovich, you have the last word.
Thank you very much. I've filed a lot of pleadings in my 45 years of practicing and a lot of Court of Appeals and Supreme Court briefs. I don't know my attorney number. Somebody in my offices has always affixed that to all my pleadings because that's the careful way to do it, not rely on my memory.
And if they got the number wrong, that's your problem.
That's right. But in this case, every single claim filed, whether it was for the 69 timesheets missing or everything else, had the correct dumpy number, had the correct Medicaid provider number for the recipient. Everything on the claims was correct. The fact that DHS and CSRS is focusing on omissions in underlying documents is the beginning of the analysis. They need to say and determine and investigate whether those issues caused any improper payments, and they didn't. With respect to the 69 timesheets, they were requested in February of 2020. They were received with my appeal letter of October 12, 2020. We went to hearing on February 14th, 2022. The department had those 69 documents for many months and could have analyzed them.
No, but I mean, the fair point is, you know, that's 8 months. Okay, 8 months to find the cloud, did it?
No. It did not take 8 months to find the cloud. There is a deadline when the department issues a monetary recovery. There is a statutory 30-day deadline to appeal. Within 30 days of realizing that they didn't have the 69 timesheets, the department had all 69 timesheets.
Okay. Go ahead, Jez.
I was going to ask you about the stipulated provider agreement. From my reading of it, don't see why it's so onerous. It just asks you to follow the law or ask your client.
It's the last paragraph. The last paragraph, if my client makes the exact same mistakes, according to the department, as they made here, DHS has the authority to suspend my client for 2 years. That's not in any statute. That authority is not in any rule. And that is overbroad. And that's why it's been appealed. Nobody can run a business with a 2-year suspension from the Medicaid, this kind of business.
If we were to rule in your favor in a presidential opinion, would we have to say we got it wrong in Best Care?
No.
Why not?
In Best Care, the facts.
And here I'm looking at the language in the opinion that says, the flaw in Relator's argument is that the rule requires the vendor to provide immediate access to all records during the inspection. That clearly wasn't done. Would that be a fair statement, counsel?
There was no inspection. In Best Care, I believe they had an actual CSRS investigation come out, sit in the office, and do an audit. This was sending a letter. And interestingly, the department amended the letter after it got the 69 timesheets. It amended the notice and order for hearing, once and amended the notice in order for hearing a second time. They had plenty of time to review the 69 timesheets. It's a different fact situation. And it's also a different fact situation because in One Best Care, that whole corruption and abuse issue comes up far more clearly. In One Best Care, you had altered timesheets.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah.
It seems like it was a lot worse.
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah.
Compared. Oh, good for you.
Yeah, so last point I want to make, though. SIR's authority does not just stop and end with PCA companies. SIRS is authorized to review the documents, or audit, rather, every Medicaid provider in this state, including hospitals, skilled nursing facilities, assisted living facilities, group homes for persons with developmental disabilities, dentists, pharmacies, and in every single one of those examples I just gave you, there's been some case in the past years where at least I've represented one client in front of SIRS of those different kinds. There are millions of pieces of paper supporting the services that people provided. If SIRS is authorized to look for any omission and turn that into money, that's going to be disastrous to the access to services and under Medicaid. This statute does not call for perfection. And the burden on the state is to prove abuse and the right for improper payments. And all of the irregularities in the timesheets did not result in improper payments. I turned 70 in September. I had a bunch of cards, birthday cards on my desk. People came in and said, "How old are you?" And I used the old lawyer joke. "I'm 70, but if you add up my timesheets, I'm 95. If the irregularities were too much services, like in SmartCare, where they billed for 20 hours of services when the person was in the hospital, that would be different. That would cause an improper payment. We don't have that here. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.